This is an ABC podcast.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? PolyTalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on PolyTalk.
Search up PolyTalk in your favourite podcast app to listen.
Talofa, Marlo, Bulvanaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. It's Friday, October 10. I'm Kyle Evans. Thanks for tuning in as we round out another week across Australia and the Pacific. Coming up today, coastal reefs are in decline, according to Fiji's most extensive marine survey. Also, dangerous and overpriced is how a new report has described accommodation provided to palm scheme workers.
We found that there's nowhere to store any of the goods. In one case, workers were sleeping on their possessions because there's nowhere in the room. It's very hard to keep it clean.
And could Fiji rugby players wishing to play in the R360 Global League be stripped of their international colours?
For us, we want to have our best players available for our best matches lined up for the next 5 years.
We'll take a look at that and more today on the show. I'm Kyle Evans. Let's dive in. But first today, dozens of candidates have registered for Tonga's national election. They're all vying for a spot in the kingdom's 26-seat parliament. As possible leaders, they will have to address an array of problems from a meth epidemic to an under-resourced civil service and struggling healthcare system. Finau Fanua visited the Election Commission office in Nukualofa yesterday, where he spoke to various candidates.
I'm standing outside the Elections Commission office in Nukualofa. There's a tent with a whole bunch of people sitting under it. They're waiting for the office to open so they can go in and register to run as a candidate in the Tonga national elections, which take place next month, November 20th. That's the day when the ballot box opens for the public. I'm going to go over and have a chat with some of them. The question I'm going to pose is, what do they think is the most urgent challenge for Tonga to resolve?
Koiha ai fo i mea o ku ke pehe o ku tonu ke resolve i he wawe taha.
O fia mao ha tokanga whaka wawe ki ai.
There's an urgent need to address this issue, and the issue is the drugs, because it's causing a lot of problems. It's impacting families, from the children to the grandparents. This is a small country, so why shouldn't we be able to deal with this issue? We have to do something about the legislation, and we all have to work together.
I think we better to solve the way how we can control the drugs here in Tonga. And not only that, the salary for the government staff.
Well, there are a lot of problems. As you know, every nation has its own challenges. I mean, I've just stepped out from a role from tourism as CEO of Ministry of Tourism. So, I mean, I can talk of the issues of tourism's facing as one of the priority sectors in this nation. Also on the employment side and social issues at the moment.
One notable candidate who I spoke to was Viliami Takao. He's the former tourism CEO for Tonga, and he's been advocating very strongly for a better health system. Earlier this year, he went viral on social media when he made a public call for government to address Tonga's stretched health system. And this followed the passing of his wife last year. His wife died in hospital, and he says that could have been avoided.
I lost my wife to our health system, so I can speak on that side. I think I'm one of the few can speak that I've experienced it. Hats off to our health workers. A lot of challenges there. I mean, health is one of them, and one of those real sensitive areas for families there.
The most notable candidate I spoke to, however, is the former Prime Minister CRC Sovaleni Huakavamiliku. He resigned as Prime Minister just a little more than a year ago, and he resigned in Parliament when a vote for a motion of no confidence against him was approved. The reason given by those who initiated the motion were concerns about government overspending, the poor state of Tonga's national airline. However, many believe this motion was influenced by the monarchy. Just weeks before his resignation, Huakawamiliku got into a public dispute with King Tubal VI. The king was unhappy with a ministerial appointment. Now, Huakawamiliku is expected to win his constituency easily. He's expected to get back into parliament. The question is, can he become prime minister again? In order for that to happen, he's going to need new faces in parliament who are supportive of him.
My focus is basically to be elected by Tuan Daptol, the number three constituency. That's my number one priority. Right now, that's my focus. I'm very happy for all the support, but I know that I still actually have to do the groundwork and actually talk to the people, tell them what I intend to do, what my plans are. Because, I mean, end of the day, it's something that they should know. They should know what they're voting for and who they're voting for.
Is this personal for you?
For me, I believe I can still help. I can still make a difference. That's why I'm sitting here.
What do you think of the current government?
I think moving forward, representatives need to work together, whatever vision or differences and so forth. But for the overall good of Tonga, I think we need to make amends and come together and work for the betterment of Tonga.
That was Tonga's former Prime Minister Siose Sobeleni, who will be running for re-election to Tonga's parliament next month. To Fiji now, where the country's most extensive marine survey has found clear signs of decline in many coastal areas, with coral reefs under growing pressure from overfishing, pollution and climate change. Surveys at 270 sites for the Blue Prosperity Fiji Ocean Science Expedition show fish stocks are thinning and coral cover is falling, confirming what local fisherfolk have long observed. The scientists that led the six-month expedition in 2023 released their first report this week and say without stronger protection and enforcement, things will get worse. Meanwhile, government ministers at the report's launch described it as a wake-up call and promised the data would be used to inform Fiji's marine spatial plan, which aims to protect at least 30% of oceans by 2030. Leading the expedition was the Waite Institute, a non-for-profit organisation embedded within the government. Its science director, Dr. Andy Estep, spoke to our Fiji reporter, Lithe Mavono.
Status quo is a downward trend. That reality is true in Fiji, that reality is true in the region, that reality is true globally. So if we look at status quo, you know, maybe it's not going down as fast, but y'all have less fish, you have more people, you have more demand, you're suffering increased global impacts, and the reality is times have changed, the rules have changed. The way that traditional governance systems engage with the modern environmental reality is different. The cultural reality is different. So, unsurprisingly, their hope spots are really... I mean, we saw spawning aggregations in the broad daylight. We saw active spawning happening on the Great Sea Reef. You don't really get to see these things all the time without knowing where to go find them. So we happened across them. There were things we got to observe where we saw, you know, thousands of fish on a single dive site aggregating and spawning. These are great signs. We also saw places where we counted like five species of fish on a single dive. So there are clear signs of impact. Unsustainable development, I think, plays a role. The loss of habitat is something that has been, you know, almost every report that I've read in Fiji underscores the importance of ridge-to-reef management. You all get a lot of rain. You have a big landmass. Nutrients run downhill, they go into your watersheds, they go into your waterways, they end up in the ocean. So everything you're doing on land finds its way into the sea and has an impact, along with everything you take out of the sea. So these impacts begin to compound and foster this new reality of the downward status quo. Overfishing is happening in Fiji. It's measurable, it's cited, and I believe every study that the NGOs and the government have done it's not a mystery that it's happening, but to the degree where, how much, when. This is why this work is important. We need to do these often, every 2 years, and then in 10 years from now, we can know a different truth. We can have a finer-tuned understanding of the status quo, and probably where there are some hopeful stories, where there are communities that are at least maintaining and beginning to improve their resources. There's work that's been done by Dr. Peter Houck and the coral reef monitoring teams in Micronesia. So these are partnerships and collaborations through the Micronesia Conservation Trust and the Micronesia Challenge. And they worked with communities that said, hey, we have a problem, and we want you to help us with the power of science to understand what we can do, where we can set up our marine protected areas. And, you know, similar, I think, to what you've heard on the Pristine Seas work, recovery happened much faster than they anticipated. I mean, within 5 years, they were measuring it in their plots. So I there's just an incredible opportunity in Fiji to leverage what you all already know, is that tambu works, protection works.
How much of our traditional methods of conservation is being fed by science?
I would say that traditional knowledge is scientific inherently. It's just cultivated and curated differently. You don't store it in a computer. You hand it down in really specific ways. The richness of protocol in Fiji was taught to us. They were worried, you know, you brought a bunch of white people in from the United States, and they need to know how to act, and they need to know how to behave. And I was just amazed at the depth of cultural protocol. And that is scientific. That carries over into how you develop and cultivate your understanding of the natural environment, and it takes a tremendous amount of time. And it's been done for so long that it's been able to be distilled into really simple sayings that seem unscientific, but they're not. So I would say that this is simply a tool, and something that, you know, traditional leadership should have access to carry on as they have been. You know, they don't need scientists telling them to go, you know, do things a certain way. It's simply, you know, another knowledge base and another thread for them to weave into their governance.
Dr. Andy Estep, a science director at the White Institute, speaking there with Lithe Mavono. Stay tuned on Pacific Beat, because coming up, we'll unpack an alarming report into palm scheme accommodation before heading to Bougainville for an update on the new government.
Pacific Beat.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Kyle Evans, and we're going to dive into some housing now, because a report by the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute has labelled the accommodation provided to workers employed under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme. They've labelled it as dangerous and overpriced. After talking to islanders about their experiences, researchers found there were widespread issues associated with the housing provided for Pacific labourers. Lucy Cooper has been speaking to researcher Todd Jones, an associate professor in geography at Curtin University in Perth, who says a combination of low pay and strict visa conditions is putting those workers at risk.
The farm workers we spoke with were mainly in Victoria, New South Wales, in three locations there. The first issue we had was that because the farm workers are quite reliant on their employers, it's actually quite difficult for them to speak to people about this. So we had to really build trust with the farm workers and work with someone who they knew well in order to establish the relationships we needed for them to be open about the accommodation they had. And so that really raises the first issue, which is the kind of control that employers have over employees in the palm scheme. So in the palm scheme, palm workers cannot leave their employer. If they leave their employer, they will basically lose their visa, and the employers provide their accommodation in most cases. So farm workers are allowed to seek their own accommodation, but this is quite difficult for them to do because they're in a different country. There can be kind of language and cultural barriers to doing that. So the employers have a lot of control, not just in the workplace, but also in their accommodation. There are guidelines for worker accommodation, so regulations that the employers have to follow when they provide homes to these people. But what we've found is the guidelines aren't really appropriate for people who are spending, in a number of cases, 4 years in Australia and then often even returning for another 4 years after that. We found that there was crowding in the bedrooms. There could be generally, you know, more than one person in a bedroom, but often, you know, four or six people. We found that there was nowhere to store any of the goods. In one case, workers were sleeping on their possessions because there's nowhere in the room. It's very hard to keep it clean. there was a lack of private space. So often palm workers are trying to maintain relationships back home. They're here to work for their families and to send money home. But there was nowhere for them to kind of have those private conversations they needed to have. We found there were weather extremes, both hot and cold in the accommodation. And we also found that they were being charged, you know, this is for sharing rooms most of the time, around $150 a week, sometimes more, sometimes less. And so these houses or even caravans that if you add up all of the, you know, all of those $150, the people staying there, they're often, in my opinion, and I guess based on the evidence we collected, above the market rates that you'd expect for them. So they're often being charged more than you'd expect. And this holds up too in terms of the palm workers who actually had gone and gotten private rentals. They found they were cheaper, the conditions were better, and they were less crowded than the, I guess, the homes that are being provided for by the employers.
What do we know about the impact on them personally, on living in these cramped living situations, sharing rooms? Well, what does that do to one's mental health?
Yeah, we found there were issues with well-being and issues to mental health. In particular, I think the absence of private space in these rooms. But obviously, staying in inappropriate accommodation for extended periods is going to impact on people. And remembering too, they're also kind of working jobs which are quite physical. Physically demanding and sometimes long hours. I don't want to generalise too much here because it wasn't really a specific focus of our study, but certainly there was evidence of impacts on well-being and mental health due to these conditions.
What needs to change in order to improve the outcomes for these workers?
So yeah, we have some recommendations which directly relate to the PALM scheme. One is that a process be put in place for farm workers to be able to change employers. So that's an important step in terms of creating a better power balance between workers and employers. Another recommendation is that a second set of standards be put in place for people who are staying 4 years. So ensure that the accommodation being provided is of a standard that we'd expect in Australia for workers. We also have some recommendations about monitoring and enforcement, where there needs to be an increase in monitoring of living conditions, information provided to workers in their housing about what the conditions are meant to be like and what they're and how to address issues that occur within it. And also, we'd like to see people employed in those monitoring positions that have the cultural capacity to work with those specific farm workers, kind of understand the culture of the places they're coming from and how to communicate appropriately to give them the opportunity to explain the issues they're facing.
That was Todd Jones, Associate Professor in Geography at Curtin University School of Design, and he was speaking there with Lucy Cooper.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
We head to PNG's autonomous region of Bougainville, where the recent election saw former President Ismail Touahraba retain his position for a second term after a strong performance. Someone who has been at the forefront of the election coverage is NBC's head journalist in Bougainville, Calvin Casper. He joins us now to discuss the president's next steps and the formation of his government. Casper, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Kyle. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me on the show.
No worries. Thank you again for joining us. Last time we had you on the program was just after the vote count where Mr. Touahraba won in quite a big landslide. Has he indicated when he'll form his new government?
Of course. Soon after the victory from the election, I've had the opportunity to talk to President Ismail Touahraba. The what we were talking about, I asked the president about the formation of the government that is incoming. President is saying that he has thoughts to form the government. The start of it would be today with the inauguration of the 5th Bougainville House of Representatives. And thereafter, next week on, that would be, we would see the Executive Council, the Bougainville Executive Council, come into formation. I've spoken to President Touahraba, who says that he wants his cabinet, the incoming cabinet, to be centered around his Bougainville People's Alliance Party. Formerly, there were other members from other political parties who were part of the executive government. President Touahraba wants this to change. He wants the executive government, he wants his cabinet to be centered around his people's alliance party. And that means he has to gather the number. People's Alliance Party has not had much numbers coming in this election, but he has to consolidate how much members he has to put in place into forming the 14-member cabinet or 14-member executive council of the Bougainville government.
Interesting. That strategy, is that something that's been done before or is that relatively new?
This is sort of new to me, Kyle. I've covered three elections for Bougainville. That is the 2010, 2015, 2020, and the recent election, which is the 2025 elections. The strategy here is Bougainville is not like Papua New Guinea where political parties is popular.
Mm.
Bougainville is it operates more on a regional recognition. So that means that if there's a party in play, it has to give regional representation and regional acknowledgement across the region from north, central, and south. So it's not a game about political parties. It's more of keeping the regional balance.
I see. Well, speaking of that regional balance, I know that five new seats were created at the last election, increasing the number of MPs from 41 to 46. What impact will these new seats have, and when will we see the new MPs be sworn in and take their seats in Parliament?
I think the immediate impact is seeing this swearing-in, the inauguration today, we'll see the new composition of the Bougainville House of Representatives, which is the 45 members from the 40-member initial parliament from the last fourth parliament. This parliament will see the swearing-in of 45 members. These are the 38 constitutional members, constituency members, single constituency members, the six regional representatives of the women and the former combatants, plus the president, which gives 45. I'd like to mention here, Kyle, the speaker of the Bougainville House of Representatives is not an elected member.
Interesting.
The speaker comes from outside. So today, when the swearing-in takes place, the clerk of parliament will table the 45 writs into parliament, and then he will adjourn parliament, and then parliament has to vote for the speaker. That means the regional committees for the House of Representatives, North Bougainville, Central Bougainville, South Bougainville, they will go into caucus, select their candidate for the speaker, and then come in, make a nomination for the speaker, and the parliament will vote for the speaker. Speaker is not an elected member.
Yes.
The speaker of the Bougainville House of Representatives is elected on its own.
Well, I guess that achieves a lot in terms of impartiality. I want to talk about independence for a second, because obviously that was very front of mind when he was elected, and he's vowed to continue his fight to deliver independence. What are we expecting from the president, and what can we expect him to do on this issue moving forward now that, you know, Parliament is being ratified?
Ismail Toroma has won by a landslide victory of 90,000 plus votes. The runner-up to him was 17,000 votes, more some thousand votes behind him. President Toroma says that the vote that he was mandated for is a confirmation, a reconfirmation of the people's wish for independence for Bougainville. That statement was initial first by the Bougainville Peace Agreement in 2001, which ended the Bougainville conflict. That same statement was carried forward in the 2019 referendum and now the 2025 general election. So President Toroma is saying that the vote that was taken in the election is a vote for independence, and he will continue the push that the people wants the government to achieve for them.
Now, Calvin, as you would know, there's been a lot of coverage in Australia and PNG recently about this new Puk Puk Defence Treaty. What's been the reaction in Bougainville to this treaty?
Puk Puk Treaty, it is really interesting. I've been seeking comments from Monday on, since the return of RITS, the Bougainville government has appointed a caretaker government, which is only three members, which are the president, the vice president, which is Ezekiel Massat, and third member, which is a women representative, Amanda Masono, from the Athol's constituency. So it is quite early. I've already sought comments from the initial reaction from the ABG. I've yet to receive any confirmation of the Bougainville government's reaction to the Puk Puk Agreement Treaty.
I see. Well, I'm sure we'll get one within due time. I'll be certainly very interested to see if we do. And just finally, Calvin, because we are running out of time, the PNG Prime Minister James Marape did make a point of telling Australian journalists that Bougainville would be a demilitarised zone and no military would be posted there. Do you think that'll reassure Bougainvillians about the future of this Puk Puk Treaty?
It's sort of a mixed reaction back here in Bougainville. Bougainville has already acted on the Bougainville Peace Agreement of 2001, which is still current, and it has achieved more to date. So the Puk Puk Agreement is sort of a really new installment into this old process. So we have to see a reaction yet from the autonomous Bougainville government, since a caretaker government is still in place until next week, when we should have a full 14-member cabinet in place. But I think it has stirred, it has raised eyebrows in the region, but we still have to have official comments and official reaction from the autonomous Bougainville government.
Yeah, that's a good description. It has raised eyebrows, but I don't think anyone really knows exactly how it's gonna look yet. So, yeah, it'll be very interesting to see when it does finally take shape. Hey, Calvin, that's all we've got time for today, but thanks so much for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on.
Not a problem at all. That was Calvin Kaspar, head journalist for NBC, talking to us there from Bougainville.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the era to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back. You're listening to Pacific Beat with Kyle Evans on ABC Radio Australia. Happy Friday. And in case you're just tuning in, here's a quick recap of our top stories. Dozens of candidates have registered for Tonga's national election, effectively putting their hand up to address an array of problems in the kingdom, from drugs to an under-resourced medical system. Meanwhile, coastal reefs are in decline, according to Fiji's most extensive marine survey. And dangerous and overpriced is how a report from the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute has described accommodation provided to palm scheme workers.
We found that there was nowhere to store any of the goods. In one case, workers were sleeping on their possessions because there's nowhere in the room. It's very hard to keep it clean.
We've got plenty more coming up in the realms of culture, dance and sport, so please stay tuned for that. We head back to Fiji now, where educators and researchers say the Tuke community is facing a growing threat, the gradual loss of traditional knowledge and customs. As younger generations take up a modern lifestyle, many of the old ways, from language to storytelling to ceremonies to fishing and land stewardship, are fading. Agi Tupo spoke to Associate Professor Dr. Lavinia Tiko from Fiji National University in Suva on what has influenced the slow disappearance of Ituke customs.
There's a growing concern about the erosion of Ituke customs. This is something I've observed both in my academic research and also in my experience as an indigenous Fijian. My PhD study focused on the indigenous Fijian notions of child development. And I explored how traditional knowledge, the values and the practices are passed down, or in many cases not passed down to the younger generations of today. And one of my key findings was that many indigenous Fijian children today are growing up with limited exposure to the manure-based knowledge systems. In some villages, the elders saw how children are no longer participating in traditional ceremonies. They understand the significance of rituals like we call it in Ituke, the traditional protocols of respect, or even the basic knowledge of their clan, or Yavusa, we say it, or Matangali, or tribe. So these were once integral to a child's upbringing, you know, in the past, which was done in daily life through storytelling, through communal living, and also through our intergenerational learning. And I remember, for example, one elder told me, our children know how to use the phone. They are smart as, but they lack our ways of learning. Even young girls and boys don't know how to weave either a basket or a mat, or even recite their chiefly or their family lineage.
So has modern day living robbed us of these cultural knowledge systems?
To me, it reflects a broader shift where the Western education and this era, the digital culture, are becoming dominant. We all know that, and often at the expense of our ways of indigenous knowing and learning. There is evidence, huge evidence, of cultural erosion. This is not just anecdotal. We see it in the declining use of the language itself among the urban children and our youths included here. Traditional child rearing practices like the velekari, that is kinship-based caregiving, and being respectful, being vakaturanga. And these are replaced by more clear family structures, especially in urban and peri-urban settings. And this shift is also visible in our education system.
Professor, how does one integrate Ituke into education or even policies?
Our indigenous knowledge, Ituke knowledge, is often treated as supplementary, you know, rather than foundational. And that is sad to say. And having said that, I can even boldly say here that there is a disconnect between what is taught in schools and what is lived in the vanua, in the villages. And it's not about preserving customs, you know, for the sake of longing. It's about safeguarding our identity. Children learn through observation. And we need to create spaces where our elders can once again pass on knowledge, whether it's through the talanoa sessions, whether it's through the village-based learning hubs, or even the digital storytelling platforms. I've seen this work beautifully in some of the communities around here, where elders are invited into the, for example, into early childhood centers, into the primary, to share their stories, to share their songs in the voice of Agaviti, in the language. If we lose that, we lose a part of who we are. I'm trying to be a radical advocate for Ituke to be integrated to me in the formal, because I'm an educator. Mm. I want this integrated into the formal education system, and I know I'm a Western counterparts would agree with this. And I'm glad that some of them are beginning to realize this. And to truly integrate Ituke knowledge into the formal education system, we must begin by you know, reframing what we define as knowledge and learning.
You know, when you talk about Ituke customs and having to preserve it, though, how significant then will it be to regional and international developments in the area?
I think that is very, very important. We need to say it out to our regional partners, to our donor, that this is us, this is how we do things. And most of, because those lenses are Western lenses. And once they know and understand the way how Itaukei learn, I think they will be able to listen to us.
Professor, what can everyday, ordinary Itaukei Fijians do to preserve their culture and language? What would be your message?
So much is said about what is happening, but there are solutions. There is a need to embed Itaukei possibilities in our curriculum, not just as a cultural add-on, but as foundational knowledge. Yalomatua, which is wisdom, and being vakaturanga or vakamaraba, respectful learning. This can be integrated into teacher training institutions, into classroom practice, and in our assessment models. We also need to recognize, and these indigenous knowledge holders are there out there in the communities. They can be our educators. You know, the chiefs, our knowledgeable elders, as I said, the artisans. They should be invited into classrooms, not just as guests, but as co-educators. You know, their presence affirms the value of Itaukei and indigenous knowledge. The culture is not something we inherit or throw away. It's something, you know, we live. It's something that we breathe and pass on. Whether I am in Suva or Sydney or Seattle, you know, you carry your vanua with you. So to every Fijian listening, to every Itaukei listening, you know, you are a vessel of culture. We need to speak it. You need to share it. Live it, and let's ensure that our children, our grandchildren, inherit not just our land, but our stories, our values, and our pride. We have a role to play here. And when we each do our part, we weave a stronger mesh for the generations to come.
Associate Professor Dr. Lavinia Tiku of the Fiji National University speaking there with Agi Tupou. Well, tatau have exploded in popularity not only among Pacific peoples, but also with non-Pacific people, online scammers and world-renowned brands. This often raises contentious arguments about cultural appropriation and who owns patterns designed by cultural practitioners. So who can have these ancient patterns etched onto their skin? And what needs to be done to control the use of this art form that links us back to our tapuna or ancestors? Johnson Rayla with this report.
The popularity of Pacific tatau or skin markings has grown rapidly in recent times, thanks largely to exposure from Pacific sports and entertainment stars. But so too has the dialogue around non-Pacific people having traditional skin markings.
It's like walking into someone's house and just sort of, you know, I really like your t-shirt that's hanging in your cupboard, so I'm just going to take that.
We've come to Papua New Guinea to meet Kista Morove, an artist who specialises in traditional PNG and Melanesian skin markings.
The most common types of traditional tattoos that I've done are mostly from the coastal areas of Papua, from Hiwikoeri to Kairuku and all the way to Arama Coast, and very special and unique in its own way.
Today, Kista will tatau Elaine. She says she's always known she's wanted traditional PNG markings.
I knew that no other tattoos would mean more to me than this, and I would be able to bear the pain of that, getting this tattoo.
Following the recent passing of her great-grandmother, Elaine decided to pay homage to her by getting the same skin marking designs.
She was the only one who had tattoos in our family, so that's why we decided to get tattoos, because we didn't want that tradition to disappear.
Elaine's cousin Sasha is here as support. They both agree that traditional skin markings should not be worn by non-Pacific peoples.
They don't really know the importance of it or the story behind the tattoos. So it's like our identity and our heritage, and it's more meaningful towards us than any other people.
It's disrespectful. Even on like clothing, when you see that, you say, oh, did they get permission from this family?
Kista agrees.
My thoughts, nah, it's just not a good idea for them to carry traditional tattoos on their bodies, because it doesn't show their identity.
Julia Mangiao Gray is a respected PNG cultural practitioner who marks skin and, like Kester, says Pacific patterns are often sacred.
I have come across people that wear our marks that have no relationship to, you know, our people, our place, and, you know, they love it. And, you know, it kind of saddens me because that's just stealing, even though you love it.
The conversation has entered the mainstream too. In 2013, following public backlash, Nike were forced to apologise and pull a range of women's sportswear from their collection that featured Samoan patterns that are traditionally reserved for men who receive the be'a, a tatau only for men.
This is knowledge that's been passed down. So when you just take that and then put that onto, I don't know, sweatpants or whatever, that's problematic. Can they not make their own? Why do they need to use us to make money? I mean, haven't we been used enough?
Tatau is one of Samoa's biggest cultural exports, and the country has shaped views around the practice globally. We've travelled here to Apia to meet Su'a Ate Suluape. Tatau is in his blood.
We were born and raised into a tattooing family, so our great-grandfather was a tattooist, so was my grandfather. And it continued passing down to my dad. And now it's our turn to carry on the family tradition.
He's allowed us rare access to film this malu process at a tatau reserved for women. Su'a isn't bothered by copycats of Samoan tatau.
Well, it's a pity that some other countries start to mimic what we're doing. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really bother me as an artist. Especially someone who was born into the tradition.
Su'a says the proliferation of Samoan tatau is a chance to educate.
It's amazed me with the impact that our culture has on those foreigners as well. So, yeah, before we work on any foreigner, we always sit down with them and, you know, have a talk with them so that they will never regret what their decision was.
That was co-host of the Pacific TV show, Johnson Rayella, giving us that report.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays, right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat, and we're going to switch to sport now because any Fijian rugby players who are considering signing up for the proposed Global League R360 will be barred from representing their country. The Fiji Union has fallen into line with the world's leading rugby nations, including Australia and New Zealand, by imposing a blanket ban. It's a move which has prompted leading figures in the game to suggest that R360 is already dead in the water. And with confirmation of Tier 1 status imminent, the FIU's chair, John Sanday, suggests the union needs all their best players on board. But if R360 can demonstrate that none would be tied down, he says his board may be willing to reconsider.
We don't have the details. We have not met R360. So, you know, based on the information that we have, that's where we are. But we're not saying that our players should never sign. It's up to them. They can sign if they want. But we need to preserve the integrity of the international test for us. And if they make themselves available during the international windows, we need to sit down and discuss. But as of now, we don't have that information.
I'm wondering then, based on what you've said, that perhaps yourselves and other nations are jumping the gun here. Maybe you need more information before making these decisions?
As we speak, the information available, that's our position. Until we get more clarification and we see how it all stacks up in relation to our test matches that are coming up over the next few years, then we will make a decision that fits that. But we don't want to prevent players from pursuing the commercial interest. That's really their entitlement. We can encourage them. But for us, we want to have our best players available for test matches lined up for the next 5 years.
So just to confirm, your decision is not cut and dried.
Well, I have not met with the R360, and none of our directors have, so we hold that position. Until that information set is renewed, where R360 sees how it can fit with us, we'll consider.
It could prove to be quite a dilemma, I would think, for a young player to resolve, because the suggestion is there will be big money involved in this tournament, but certainly as far as Fiji is concerned, we're awaiting confirmation of Tier 1 status. You're a team on the move, so for a player to turn his back on playing international rugby for Fiji, that would be a huge decision.
It's every young man's dream in Fiji to wear the white jersey. And, you know, the financial rewards for that is improving considerably. So, you know, as we line up more test matches and we get better revenues, that can only get better. We may not be able to match whatever is being offered out there. It's still a lucrative package. And much more important than the financial rewards is the pride for the family, the pride for the village, the pride for the country. For one of us to wear the white jersey and play international test matches and also be rewarded reasonably well is plenty. But it is a dilemma. We have to make sure we draw the line where our interests are, and we want to protect that.
As far as the question of Tier 1 status is concerned, are we still waiting for the official announcement? And if so, what's keeping world rugby? It seems to be the worst kept secret in rugby.
Well, there's things that I can say and there's things I can't say. But we're well on our way there, and it's just a matter of when that announcement will be made. So regardless, we will play Tier 1 level rugby on the field and match the high-performing nations ball for ball and man for man, and we play to win. And while that's happening, we are also working on our internal processes to be in full compliance with international best practices. So, yes, we're moving along.
Recently, of course, the Flying Fijians retained the Pacific Nations Cup. I've seen it suggested since then that perhaps the team has outgrown that particular tournament. Is that the way you see it? And once Tier 1 status is confirmed, will you be looking to go bigger effectively?
If you look at PNC, the last few years, Japan and Fiji have been playing in the finals, and Japan is already Tier 1. So that tells you a lot about the standards Fiji has achieved. We're there with them. And when we get our best team in place and we've had the best preparation, we are able to knock off any of the big boys.
Are we heading, therefore, towards a situation where matches between yourselves, Manu Samoa and Kalitahi may not be so regular?
Well, I think the realities of geography will be that we will be playing regularly, and then also we owe it to our brothers in the neighborhood to keep playing regularly, to bring them up as well. Fiji has always performed that role. We toured Samoa, we toured Tonga in the 1920s and toured them regularly and played matches regularly, and together we've grown. So I think there's an extra responsibility, or there's an extra level of brotherhood there that we'll always play each other. So whilst we have kind of outgrown that level, we still want to see Tonga and Samoa up along with us. And, you know, particularly at this point when Samoa is struggling to get into the qualification run for the World Cup, our hearts are with them to see how we can support them better, if there's anything we can do to help them get through the last qualifying round so that all three of us qualify for the Rugby World Cup in Australia. It's an Oceania event that we're all looking forward to. We are quite clear on where we want to be. The results are speaking volumes, and it's a reflection of the work that's done by everybody in the rugby family of Fiji, from the board all the way down to the club level, everybody working in unison. And that's something that has been a big inspiration for me, to see everybody working together toward the goal.
John Sanday, a former Flying Fijian himself and now chair of the Fiji Rugby Union. And he was talking there with Richard Ewart on the line from Suva. And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat today. But we'll be back at the same time Monday morning. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned, though, on ABC Radio Australia, because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nija Daily. My name's Carl Evans. Have a fantastic weekend.